Today, it's the secrets of the Federal Reserve. Eustace, the Federal Reserve, it says federal right on this book. That must mean it's a governmental agency, doesn't it?
Well, it means it's as federal as Federal Express. that's the true meaning of federal.
You mean to tell me that the United States government does not own the Federal Reserve System? Because it's my understanding that the Federal Reserve System controls the money of the populace, the general people of the United States. And are you telling me that it's not the government of the United States, the Federal Reserve?
Well, that is a secret of the Federal Reserve, is that it's not federal, and it has no reserves, and it's not a system at all. It's actually a criminal syndicate.
It's a criminal syndicate.
Well,
how can you say that? Tell us about that, Eustace Mullen.
Well, I can say that because north of here, there's a millionaire's retreat called Jekyll Island, Georgia, which for many years was the private preserve of some of the wealthiest families in the United States. They met there in secret in Thanksgiving of 1910 to draft a money monopoly plan, which they intended to force on the people of the United States. And because they met in secret, this was a criminal conspiracy, and the Federal Reserve System came out of a criminal conspiracy. That's why I call it a criminal syndicate. And anyone at the Department of Justice would have to agree with me on that.
Now, when they met, apparently, from what I've read, is that they said that at that time it was going to help the farmers because there was going to be more loans that would be available to farmers, and that the Federal Reserve System was for the middle-class American people. Is it true? I mean, in the long run, did it turn out to be a benefit to middle-class America, Eustace?
Well, their approach was that these very wealthy people were setting up this privately owned money monopoly to help everyone else. In other words, it was going to be compassion and caring all the way. And it was presented to Congress as a bank reform bill. And there were not going to be any more bank failures. There'd be no more monetary panics. There'd be no more financial depressions. And, of course, from 1914, when they started operation, we went right to 1929, the biggest crash we ever had.
Was the Federal Reserve System itself, was it also, do you think, partially responsible for World War One, Eustace Mullen?
Not partially, totally. You see, they had wanted to have a major war since 1885. The problem was all the European countries were bankrupt because they had central banks. Whenever you install a central bank in a country, that is a sure road to ruin for everyone in that country. And we prospered throughout the 19th century because we did not have a central bank.
Now, could you explain to me what a central bank is versus, shall we say, the national government bank? Because it's a little bit of verbicide here. We don't know. Federal Reserve, I mean, it seemed to me like the word federal itself, of course, we talked about, had to be a government institution. So if you could tell me the difference there.
Well, that phrase was coined by Paul Warburg, one of the original conspirators at Jekyll Island in 1910, for that very reason. He was a very clever person. And a central bank is different from an ordinary bank, is that an ordinary bank or a government bank would be a bank of the people to provide the people with money. And a central bank is a privately owned bank, which always takes the name of a country. You have the Bank of England, you have the Bank of Italy. These are privately owned banks which function as government banks, but except that the private owners get all the profits. And the people of the countries which have a central bank, they progressively become poorer. Now, when the Federal Reserve Act was passed by Congress in 1913, we had no national debt. The dollar was 100 cents in purchasing power. Today, we have $4 trillion. Where did you and I get $4 trillion in debt? Did you go out and spend a lot of money that you shouldn't have, or did I? Absolutely
not.
Don't
ask me that.
Well, I think you might spend $4 trillion, but it would take you a little while. But no, all that money not only has been wasted, but it's been deliberately wasted to put us into permanent debt situation.
Now, how is this money created? Because you're telling me that the government, our government ourselves, gave up the right to coin this money. And then all of a sudden the Federal Reserve System has the right to make dollar bills, Federal Reserve notes. Was there trickery involved there? But first of all, how did this happen? You talked about 1913, you talked about Jekyll Island. What were the mechanics that led to the change from the government owning the money and issuing the money to its people versus the Federal Reserve?
Well, I mentioned the conspiracy at Jekyll Island because it took a lot of plotting to get the people of the United States to accept a privately owned central bank. You see, we had one set up by Alexander Hamilton in 1787, the first bank of the United States. And Thomas Jefferson opposed it, and he got rid of it in 1812. So that caused the War of 1812. The British attacked us again in 1812 because Jefferson had put an end to their bank, and they retaliated with the War of 1812. In fact, you will find banking interests behind every major event of world history. They pull the strings. We're just puppets. The governments are puppets, and that's why the War of 1812 happened. The Civil War, World War I, World War II, you name it. They're bankers' wars.
I've been told and I've heard that World War I, just take that for example, there's probably no reason at all to ever have World War I. There was an assassination, and then there was a demand for an apology, and the apology was given. And pretty soon, shortly after that, Europe was entered into the war, the United States was entered into the war. And could you explain to me what Belgian relief plan was as far as World War I?
The Belgian relief plan was to relieve the Belgians who didn't need any relief. It was actually, you see, in 1916, Germany, through private sources, approached the Allied governments and said, I'm sorry, we can't go on with the game, you know, because to them, to the bankers, war is a game. They set up two opposing teams and have them play each other, and they're making money from both sides. So the game had gone on for 2 years, financed by the Federal Reserve System of the United States in 1914. As I said, they had no money for this war. But by passing the Federal Reserve Act, suddenly the money and credit of the American people was made available to the central banks of Europe to finance the First World War. That's the reason you had it. That's why you had all that bloodshed. That's why you had the suffering. That's why you had the collapse of monarchical governments in much of Europe, all brought about as a banking conspiracy. So in 1916, the Kaiser said, look, we're bankrupt. We're out of food, we have no fuel, so we're going to sue for peace. Well, this did not fit in with the program of the international bankers because they hadn't even gotten the United States into the war yet in 1916, and that was part of the plan, that we had to get into it. So they said, all right, we'll take care of you. We'll get you food, and we'll get you fuel, and we'll get you money. Well, the money was no problem because these international bankers operate all over the world. They got him the money. But the food was a different situation. How was the United States to furnish food to Germany so they could continue to fight for another 2 years? And so it had to be done through subterfuge. And so they called upon Herbert Hoover, an old Rothschild employee, whom they had hired, by the way, because he had been barred for life on the London Stock Exchange as a notorious swindler. And the Rothschilds said, get this guy, we need him. So he went to work for them. And sure enough, in World War I, they said, Herbert Hoover is the man to set up a Belgian relief commission to feed Germany so we can have another 2 years of world war. And that's exactly what happened. The great engineer, he was called. He was there, actually, the
he
great...
He engineered a 2 years longer for that war, anyway.
Well, he was the great swindler. He was the most notorious promoter of mining stocks in the world. And, he particularly promoted gold mining stocks. And, you know, a gold mine is a mine in which someone sells you the stock in a gold mine, and they take the gold and give you the shaft. And so this was Herbert Hoover's background. He'd always given people the shaft. And so they said, now he's on the biggest swindle of all time. He's going to operate the Belgian Relief Commission. And he said, yes, I'll run the Belgian Relief Commission for you, and we'll feed Germany with one proviso. I get all the money. And he did. Herbert Hoover came out of World War I, and the Belgian Relief Commission is one of the richest men in the world.
No, it's my understanding that actually in World War I, 21,000 people in America also became millionaires amid the death and the destruction and the slaughter and the hardships of these soldiers. 21,000 people actually became millionaires. Does war itself, does it create different classes of individuals from a financial standpoint?
Well, war is enormously profitable because it's so destructive. You see, modern technology and modern industry produces so much that the competition drives the prices down, everybody goes bankrupt. So you have a war, and it destroys so much that then everybody gets rich again, replacing all the stuff that was destroyed in the war. That's the story of modern economy.
I read in your book also, Eustace, that the average working man, what they have said, and we're talking about members of the Federal Reserve, and we're talking about the elitist core, that the average working man should never rise above the certain level, that the rest of the income he takes in, the majority of that should be taken by taxes. Are we in a situation today where the average working man is just barely getting along, spending his whole life working, not being able to enjoy the opportunities and joys of life?
Well, actually, it's gotten a little worse than that. You've got all these homeless people sleeping under bridges. So it's actually, the plan of the international bankers is to have all of the producers, the workers, live on a bare subsistence level. And this is the basis of all taxation, of all governmental control of industry, is to make sure that the workers do not have a comfortable living, because they're afraid if they get too comfortable, they won't work as hard, you see. And this plan was devised by the diabolical mind of a man named David Ricardo in England in the early 19th century. He was an associate of the Rothschilds. He had become enormously wealthy through associating with the Rothschilds as a stock speculator in London. And so when these people make a lot of money, then they have leisure to sit down and figure out devilish plans to enslave everybody in the world. For some reason, when you get a lot of money, that's all you can think about, is making sure that everybody else in the world is going to work for you for the rest of their lives at a bare subsistence level. This is the plan David Ricardo worked out, and this is the basis of all governmental programs in the United States today. It's to keep the people at a bare subsistence level.
Now, we have this Federal Reserve system. Who owns the Federal Reserve, Eustace Mullins?
Well, any citizen of the United States will tell you, oh, the Federal Reserve system is owned by the government. And, of course, they've been brainwashed to accept that. You go to any university in the United States, Yale, Harvard, take all the economics courses, they will never tell you that the Federal Reserve system is privately owned. Because the purpose of the universities is to misinform you, to keep you deluded.
By the way, do you mean to tell me that this program that we're doing today, Eustace Mullins, you'll find out more about the Federal Reserve than you will at Harvard or Yale in a full four-year course?
Absolutely. In fact, you'll be finding it out for the first time because no one else is going to tell you this. And what they do is they hire, as professors of economics at the major universities, they pay them $100,000 a year to prevent them from ever telling their students any of the realities of economic life in America today.
Okay, you have an ownership of a small group of people in this Federal Reserve? Are there a large group of people? Are there 100 people or 8 people or 20 people that have stock in this Federal Reserve system?
There are 100 families who own the stock of the 12 Federal Reserve banks. The government has never owned one share of any Federal Reserve bank. And the present banking chairman of the banking committee in Congress, Henry Gonzalez, he even says that it is a government bank, that it is not privately owned. And how he could say that, when I published this book in 1952, it's been in print ever since, that the government has never owned a share of stock in the Federal Reserve banks. Well, the pretext that to put this over on the people is that the president of the United States, who has been chosen and elected by the bankers, then chooses people who will serve as Federal Reserve Board of Governors. And they supposedly control the economic life of the United States. And, of course, they're all stooges.
Now, if you take money, and if you're the one that can increase the money, or if you can have inflation or deflation, how does that itself, Eustace Mullins, how can that help or hinder a society, the increase of... And were these depressions that we had in this country, were they planned depressions?
Every depression was artificially engineered by purely mechanical means, by suddenly decreasing the money supply, by telling the banks to foreclose all their loans. And in other words, you bankrupt everybody one fell swoop. Well, why do they want to bankrupt everybody? So they could take over their property at 1 cent on the dollar.
These gigantic foreclosures, I mean, we're talking about virtually tens of thousands of homes today in 1993 that are being foreclosed against. Is that part of this conspiracy against middle America by the international banking system or the Federal Reserve System?
That's absolutely correct. You see, the great enemy of the bankers and their conspiracy is an educated, well-informed middle class. They don't worry about the poor people because the poor people do not have enough capital or independence to ever mount any resistance. But the middle class can, because the middle class wants to defend its private homes, its little car sitting in the driveway, downsized, of course, the downsized home, the downsized car. These are all products of the bankers' conspiracy. I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't drive a car as long as this room, except the bankers want you to have a little car to keep you in your place. That's the whole idea.
You know, Eustace, one of the things I can recall 20 years ago or so, that gas used to be 25 or 35 cents a gallon, somewhere in there, whether it's premium or if you had unleaded or if you had regular. Now, we go from 25, 35, now it's $1.35, $1.40, whatever it may be. But there was this gigantic boom, and I was told back in 1972 that the Federal Reserve of St. Louis determined that they wanted 80% of the food and the fiber that was produced in this country, they wanted that in ownership of about 100,000 corporations. You see, we used to have 40 million farmers in this country, but they wanted to level those farmers down and put it in the form of corporations so they could control this food. And then the second thing was the fuel. But, you know, when I listen to things like that, I think it's so absolutely bizarre. Why would you take the strength of a culture, the farmer that can go out and raise a fine crop of children and give morality and give understanding and close to the soil, why would you take them away from the soil using the means of a Federal Reserve or the twisting of the money and inflation and deflation? Why would anybody want to do that, Eustace?
Well, the bankers do not want to see a strong, viable country or nation anywhere in the world. They want a weak, despairing people who are struggling for their daily bread, who could never mount opposition to them. They're the enemy of every nation in the world. And they work from within to destroy it. As you say, they weaken the country. I mean, why today in the schools is it so important to educate 6-year-old students on the importance of choosing an alternative lifestyle, of becoming homosexuals? Most 6-year-old students are not really concerned about what their future sex life is going to be, but they find that the program is so important, they've got to make them make up their minds by the time they're 7 years old that, well, I've decided I'm going to be a homosexual. And then it means no children, no stable home life, no nothing.
So you say that there's all these little conspiracies, it seems like, within a conspiracy, and it's meant to drive the morality of America to a very low ebb, the lowest we've been in for forever since our country began?
They're conducting war. I mean, you just saw the big shootout at Waco. That's really typical of these people. They want to make war on you. And it's not government, it's the people behind the government. There is no government in the United States. And what you have are these conspirators behind the government. You have Bill Clinton being chosen out of nowhere to be president of the United States, member of the Trilateral Commission, coming out of a backward state like Arkansas, one of the poorest states in the United States, because the Rockefellers went in there and bought it in 1946. Winthrop Rockefeller III owns Arkansas, and he owns Bill Clinton. The Rockefellers own him lock, stock, and barrel.
Okay, now we found out, Eustace, so far that the Federal Reserve itself is not a government agency. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Not a government agency. But yet they say that the President of the United States appoints certain people to the Federal Reserve. If he can appoint people to the Federal Reserve, don't we, you and I, as taxpaying citizens, have some control over the Federal Reserve?
Well, have you ever suggested a candidate for the Federal Reserve Board to your congressman?
No, I haven't.
And if you did, how much attention would he pay to you? I mean, suppose you said, look, I'd like to see Eustace Mullins on the Federal Reserve Board. So you write your congressman. Here's a man who spent 50 years studying the Federal Reserve System. Why don't you put him on there and let him work with these people? I can tell you what, your letter would go right in the trash because these people are chosen out of New York and London and Paris. And their background has to be that they're part of the system. or they wouldn't even be considered.
Okay. We have a system. We have a system that works against the middle class.
Right.
And that system, how does it get its money? Where does it make its money from? Does it print money?
They have what they call the magical money machine, where you put in a blank piece of paper and crank out a $100 bill. And, of course, con artists used to sell machines like that at county fairs to the suckers. So now these bankers got together and sold that machine to the people of the United States.
And we're all the suckers for it, I guess. Huh?
Well, they put in the blank pieces of paper and they hand out $100. But they don't give you the $100. You have to give them $100 worth of labor or real estate for it. In other words, nothing is free. In order to perpetuate their ownership of the magical money machine, the Federal Reserve System, they entered into the bill in 1913 when it went through Congress that you and I could never buy a share of stock in the magical money machine. In other words, the people who bought the original stock in 1914, they own it all today. It cannot be bought or sold on any stock exchange, because if you own a magical money machine, why would you let the suckers buy it from you? You sell them the paper. You don't sell them the machine itself.
Well, how did they purchase this magical money machine? I mean, did they pay somebody off, or was it... I mean, you mentioned before Jekyll Island, and I heard that there was a no-name club at Jekyll Island. Would you tell us a little bit about that, Eustace Mullen?
Well, these are very important bankers who met there secretly in November of 1910. They left Hoboken on a sealed train, and the reporters were there, because these were very important people, and the reporter said, where are you going? And they were all shouting and trying to get into the train to ask some questions. The train pulled out. They wouldn't say where they were going. They went to Brunswick, Georgia, which was the stopping place for Jekyll Island, which is just across the inlet there. And they went over to their private club, and they wrote the act in secrecy, and they stipulated it would be called a Federal Reserve System to delude the public. They stipulated that they would own the stock forever. You and I would never be allowed access to this stock. And they set up a money monopoly in violation of Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which provided, the Founding Fathers made sure to guarantee the people of the United States they would have their own money. Congress would have control over the money. So then, after they wrote this secret plan, they had to take it before Congress and persuade Congress to turn over this money power to the private bankers. They did it through bribery, through intimidation, and they got it through just before, they actually put it through after the Christmas vacation started, when some of the opponents left. Congressman Charles Augustus Lindbergh, the father of the aviator, had fought this bill through Congress. He said it establishes a perpetual money trust, and our children will be enslaved by this money trust. He said it all in 1913, and it all has come true. So they got the bill through on December the 23rd, 1913, after the opponents had left, and they immediately rushed it through. No other bill has ever been passed by Congress under the strange circumstances that the Federal Reserve Act was passed. And even the New York Times pointed out, they said, never has legislation of such major importance been passed in such circumstances. So,
what about the IRS? Did that come in near that same time?
Same year, 1913. The income tax amendment was passed in 1913. The Rockefeller Foundation was chartered in 1913. The Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913. So that we could have a world war a few months later in 1914.
We're here for
all
the
of
lost.
This
and for
the
you found.
See, 1913 is a symbolic year.
On the internet,
because we're dealing with people who have a deep root in the occult and in satanic work. So for them, 1913 was the year that they wanted to force everything over on the American people, and they did.
Now, the IRS, if you have the Internal Revenue Service, which is a collection agency for the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve, because those are two points, those are two of the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto. Would you say that as of 1913, from a legal standpoint for this country, that we were 20% communist at that time?
Oh, very much so. This is a communist system. In fact, the Federal Reserve bankers originated communism. That's not generally known. But and you have the spectacle after the Bolshevik Revolution was perpetrated on the Russian people, and they murdered the Tsar and his family. They murdered the Tsar out of hatred, greed, and envy, which is the basis of all communism. Hatred, greed, and envy. This hatred, greed, and envy is the basis of every government act passed by Congress in the United States, because they hate the middle class, their greed makes them want to seize the assets of the middle class, and they have such envy that they cannot stand for anyone else to be well-dressed, well-educated, or have a nice home. They want to reduce us all to the status of Chinese coolies or serfs in old Russia.
What do we do? I mean, there must have been some people at that particular time that saw through this con game. What happened to them? People like, say, Bronson La Follette from Wisconsin and Charles Lindbergh that you mentioned. What happened to those people? Because they did stand up, some of them, didn't they, Eustace?
They did, and after Lindbergh opposed them, they financed mobs to chase him through the streets of Minnesota towns where he was a congressman and to threaten to tar and feather him. He was lucky to escape with his life. They took his books and threw them out in the piles of the street and burned them. He wrote books exposing his situation. You can hardly find those books today. They were burned.
Now, you mean to tell me that also, would they, is that how they've been doing it? They've been buying people off ever since 1913 to keep their game? And I know in the government today there's a request by many congressmen to have an audit of the Federal Reserve. Could that do any harm?
Actually, an audit of the Federal Reserve would simply substantiate their legitimacy. I mean, you don't want to audit the mafia. Why would you audit the Federal Reserve? It's an illegal organization to start with. You don't audit a criminal syndicate. You put it out of business, and you lock up the people who perpetrated this on the American people.
Let's go back to Andrew Jackson, because Andrew Jackson threw the bankers out one time, didn't he?
He did, indeed.
And the country prospered.
Oh, tremendous prosperity. Andrew Jackson, as President of the United States, said to the bankers, "Ye are a nest of vipers, and by God I will root you out." And so he immediately took all government funds out of this second bank of the United States, which was a central bank, and of course they went bankrupt because they needed that money for their operating capital. And in fact, today, every bank and every business in the United States is operating on the Social Security taxes that they collect from their workers by extortion, because without that capital, they couldn't exist.
Now, what about the Rockefellers and the Kuhn Loebs and some of the Lazarus brothers? Who actually owns the stock? What are some of the names of the people that own the stock in this Federal Reserve system?
Well, you know, I was the first person to ever publish those names. In fact, Congressman Wright Patman, who was chairman of the Banking Committee of the House back in the 1950s, and I used to visit him as often. He was a great admirer of my book, and I have his letter reproduced in the book. And he said, "You know, Eustace, I'm sitting in his office," and he said, "There are two things I need." He was getting old. He said, "There are two things I want to do before I die. I want to find out who owns the stock of the Federal Reserve banks, and I want to audit them." Well, he died without achieving either objective. And at that time, I myself had not completed my research to find out who the owners were. And I finally found out about 10 years after Wright Patman died, and that information is in there. And, of course, no surprise that the owners of the stock since 1914 are the big rich, the elitists, the Rockefellers, the Harrimans, the Warburgs, the Schiffs. And in fact, Governor Clinton, the representative of the little man, is now going to send Pamela Harriman to Europe as an ambassador.
Tell us about, how do the Harrimans, and tell us about Prescott Bush and George Bush. I mean, if this is going to be a conspiracy, it has to kind of go up the ladder, doesn't it? I mean, are these families that kind of work themselves in and then just stay there forever?
Well, that's absolutely true, because in order to have reliable people, you have to have families which continue generation after generation. I call them the dynastic families of the world order, because these are true dynasties. You know, the old monarchical dynasties of Europe are pretty well gone, except for the British royal family. And the reason that they are still in power is they represent the old Canaanites, which go back 5,000 years, the black nobility. And in fact, most of the wealthy families of the world today are, I'd say all of them are the black nobility. They're all interrelated. They have arranged marriages to protect the money, you see. And they have common goals. They have a common program. So no one is going to get in there and upset the apple cart. Now, sometimes they marry outside of their family patterns, but the people they marry are playboys. In other words, they could go to the Riviera, they can have their yachts, but they never interfere with the program of the world order.
So we're talking about the power of money, I guess, huh?
Well, it's the power of power, because money is power. You cannot issue money unless you have power. I mean, I cannot hand you a piece of blank paper and say, listen, this is a $100 bill, they'll give me $100 for it. In order for you to do that, I have to have power over you. So the power comes first, and the money is simply a medium of exchange, a medium of control. And in fact, the money that we have today is an obligation. It's a promissory note, promise to pay. In other words, the government has no money. You and I have no money, unless we have gold and silver. What we have are promissory notes, which, by the way, Paul Warburg was so brilliant that in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, he stipulated, and it's right in the act, you could read it, that these printed pieces of paper, which the private bankers are printing for their own profit, are then to become full obligations of the government of the United States. In other words, of the taxpayers. They can print all the billions of dollars they want, and as soon as they print that money, you and I owe that money. Not only do we owe it, but we've got to start paying interest on it immediately.
In other words, they can take a thin piece of paper, write a $1,000 bill, print that $1,000 bill, and they have created this money out of nothing. Are you telling me that?
They have testified before Congress that they create the money out of nothing. Because they have to testify that, because where else would it come from? It comes out of nothing. It's bookkeeping ledger entries. In other words, the Federal Reserve stockholders, these wealthy families, will enter into a ledger $1 billion. And they say, now, government of the United States, American people, you owe us $1 billion. And if you don't start paying interest immediately, we'll foreclose on you.
That's the way to do it, huh?
That's the way.
How come you and I couldn't have thought of that game?
Well, we should have thought of it first. Now we're out of the picture, see?
But as my understanding in the Bible, there were two things that Jesus said was an abomination. And the second thing was usury.
That's right, usury.
And is that the reason that our country is so indebted today, because of this usury system by a group of people that print money for nothing and we pay in bondage to keep the system going?
Well, that's exactly correct. And my mentor, Ezra Pound, who started me on a campaign to study the Federal Reserve System in 1948 and commissioned me to go to the Library of Congress, he said, see what you can find out about the Federal Reserve System. Well, I didn't give a hoot about the Federal Reserve System. I was going to write the great American novel, and I had no interest. I didn't even have a bank account.
You have, right
time.
Here.
Well, I guess it is. It's more interesting than a novel. And so I went down there, and I found out it was a criminal conspiracy, and I came back. See, Ezra was a political prisoner held in an insane asylum for 13 and a half years without trial. I finally got a congressman interested in his plight, and that opened the door. He walked out a free man, just like that. You have to have someone to intercede for you, because you're dealing with a diabolical government which responds only to force or the threat of exposure. And that's what Congressman Usher Burdick did. He went on the floor of Congress. He said, why is the government holding this man? Well, they had no answer, so they released him.
So you knew a poet by the name of Ezra Pound. He commissioned you to write the first book on the Federal Reserve. He was incarcerated at that time in the United States Penal Institution or whatever, but the point is then Mr. Burdick, congressman from North Dakota, he was the one who was able to have Ezra Pound released. Is that correct?
He was indeed, and that's why you always need someone who can intercede for you, because you're dealing with a diabolical government. If you don't have some way of having someone intercede with you, you're helpless.
Now, Eustace, we have the Federal Reserve System. Does the Federal Reserve System itself, I happen to think that I've been patriotic most of my life, but the more that I see about this government, I'm not talking about the country because I love my country, but the government to me seems more and more diabolical, and I've seen my friends in business, good quality, hard-working, middle businessmen that are not in business anymore. And something has to be, I mean, there was some reason that they're not in business. It seems to me the giant corporations now own the majority of the wealth of the country. Am I imagining things, or is the small businessman, small farmer, small select individual, are they being financially wiped out?
Well, they're being wiped out by the Federal Reserve System through the Internal Revenue Service. Now, I have a friend named Paul Desfossis. He and I travel around the country lecturing together. He was an IRS agent for 20 years. And the program, he told me, the program of the IRS for the past 10 years has been to close down every small business, every independent, privately owned farm in the United States. Because it's easier to control people who have no assets, who have to work for a salary for somebody. And they intend...
Well, why would the government do that, Eustace?
For control. They want the Fortune 500 to own everything in the United States, to control all business, so that they don't have to deal with individuals. You see, the federal government has no power over an individual. People don't realize that. You don't even have to talk to an Internal Revenue agent, because Article 1, Section 8 of the Congress says, Congress shall have power to provide for the common defense, that is, raise armies, and for the common welfare of the United States. Well, the United States means the federal entity. So Congress, no federal entity, has any power over the individual citizen. Only the states can deal with its citizen.
You know, looking back, Eustace, in my childhood, and I'd come home, and you'd see in most homes whether it was in Wisconsin or Georgia or California or New York or wherever, you see nice homes with a picket fence around. You'd see a man coming home after work with a lunch bucket, and he was raising three or four or five children. Normally his wife didn't work. He had probably one car in the garage. He had a nice bus system where he could go to and from work. He had a nice paycheck, and he could actually support his family. One person could support the whole family. And there was silver that was one of the commodities of the exchange, and you had gold, and I guess even partially at that time, but the value of the money seemed to be so strong in comparison to what we have. Now, we've gone from this situation, Eustace, where a man could stand up and feed his family and be proud, to today, we have sometimes two and three and four people working in a family just to support the same lifestyle that my father produced for our family 40 years ago. Now, has the Federal Reserve, does it have anything to do with this change in lifestyle or the way we have to work so hard just to make ends meet today?
Oh, this has been a deliberately engineered program whereby the wife has to go out and earn a living. She cannot stay home and raise the children. They want the state to control the children. In fact, Hillary Clinton is in the White House today to absolutely ensure that the parents will no longer have any say-so on the life of an American child. They are to become wards of the state. They are to be totally controlled by the state. In other words, after a man and a wife has a child, they no longer will have any authority over that child. The state will have total authority.
Well, that's, of course, the most bizarre thing that I have ever heard in my life. But let's take it one step further. Now, we know there's a Federal Reserve System. We know also that it's privately owned. The stock is privately owned. You and I could never purchase that stock. Nobody in America except this little elitist core. They make billions of dollars, and the majority of the American middle class is suffering from it. We owe over $4 trillion in debt, huge budgets. The government doesn't seem to respond because they're paid off. Would you say that they're paid off one way or another, most of these congressmen and senators?
They're all paid off. Well, who did Bill Clinton bring to Washington as his new staff? He got the top insiders, the top lobbyists, the top lawyers in Washington. These are people who are accustomed to earning $500,000 a year. People like that are easy to control because they want to go on earning $500,000 a year, $10,000 a week. And when you pay people that kind of money, you own them. They're never going to object. I don't care. If you tell them, go down there to Texas and and murder a bunch of children in a little church, they'll do it.
Now, Eustace, what if we could change this system? What if we took the Federal Reserve and we went back to where our government, with good, solid congressmen, non-lawyers, were running our republic? How long do you think it would take for this country to get back on its feet, be independently wealthy, get rid of its indebtedness, and have money enough so each family and jobs enough could support themselves and live in a substantial standard of living? How long would it take, do you think?
Well, you couldn't do it overnight. It would take about 6 weeks.
In 6 weeks, you're saying if we did get our government back, if we got that Federal Reserve back, and I understand that there's a method we can get that Federal Reserve back. Tell us about that, Eustace.
Well, you see, as I sopped to the congressmen who still were not totally convinced about the wisdom of having a Federal Reserve system passed by Congress, the very last part of the Act, Section 34, says Congress retains the right to alter or repeal this act at any time. Now, all that means is, that language means that tomorrow Congress can meet and say, well, let's buy back the Federal Reserve stock, $144 million, which, by the way, if they appropriated the $144 million to buy back the stock of the Federal Reserve, they would wipe out a $4 trillion debt. That'd be quite a bargain, wouldn't it?
That would be about the bargain of every century that I know of since time began.
And we need a bargain. But that's how simple it is. You see, regardless of all the damage that has been done by these people, by their insidious plotting, by their paranoid conspiracies, that can be corrected. The American people are still sound. I have total faith in the people of this country.
I think they really just need to know the truth, Eustace, and from that truth, I believe that if they knew the truth, that they'd make the correct decisions, don't you think?
Well, why do you think the Federal Reserve bankers control the major television networks? Because they only want their propaganda to go out to the people. They realize that 3 days on television could inform all the American people of everything that's gone on.
Now, Eustace, you and I have been talking briefly here. Now, in the next couple, 3 minutes, tell us just a thumbnail sketch of what we've learned about the Federal Reserve System.
Well, we've learned it's a criminal syndicate. See, the American people know the mafia is a criminal syndicate, but the mafia is not doing the damage to the American people that the Federal Reserve is. So, therefore, we go after this criminal syndicate, we put them out of business, and what we do is we liberate the people. It would be a new revolution.
Okay, we have the new revolution, we take the Federal Reserve System back, we put people to work, and the reason they go to work is because they have sound money after that. Is that correct?
That's correct. They get a return for their labor. You see, the income tax is a tax on your labor. It's a tax on your property. It is not a tax on income. There is no such thing as income. What you have is the product of your labor, and that's what they're stealing from you.
I really think, Eustace, that we could have such tremendous building and construction across this country if there was a sound money system. People would be building homes, they'd be building their vacation areas, they would be at work. And to me, the biggest thing that this system, the Federal Reserve System, has taken from us as a country and as a family and as a group, and that is the hope for the future. Because today there doesn't seem to be much hope. In other words, you have health problems for the country, you have all crime, you have rampant, everything I think, though, can be related, whether it's the drugs or the S&Ls. I think those things can all be related to the Federal Reserve. Do you think that?
Oh, I certainly do. And the adult middle class is totally convinced there is no hope today, but the young people have not quite realized it yet, and that's why the young people are our hope, because they have no idea how grim things really are.